You're listening to the Food Talk Show, produced by Channel Radio. It's the Food Talk Show with me, Paul Andrews, and the lovely Sue Nelson. Good afternoon, Sue. How are you?
Good afternoon. I've got a bit of that horrible lurgy that everybody seems to have at the moment. Yeah, you know, that sort of horrible chest and sore throats. But I'm going to soldier on, Paul. But my voice might sound a little bit sexier than normal.
Oh, well, that's a benefit, isn't it? Yeah, but you need to get yourself tucked up with a port and brandy or something.
I do, indeed. I'm thinking about doing that later.
I don't blame you at all. Well, let's hope we can get through this without any coughing and choking and spluttering.
Exactly. Listen, we've got a really, really busy programme as well, because I've been out and about with a microphone.
Wow.
Which is just as well, because my voice is not very good today. So that's pretty fortunate, isn't it? Really.
That's what you call planning.
It is. Well, just about. Mm-hmm. I've been talking to some really, really interesting people lately. So first up today is going to be Stephen Dring. Mm. And he's been growing all sorts of plants underground that he sells. In a really big way.
Hold on. Wasn't that a Jam track, Growing Underground?
Yeah, Growing Underground. That's the name of his company. It's brilliant. And they've been growing stuff underground, obviously, growing underground.
Wow.
And they've been using disused tunnels from Transport for London. So they've been growing them in train tunnels.
Wow.
Oh, that's great, isn't it?
That is so cool.
Yeah, so you have to listen to Stephen. He's got a really great business model there.
Mm.
And then... this sounds like a really weird topic, but it's very, very important and fascinating. And we're talking to Lee Shepherd of Appetito. And he's talking about people who have swallowing difficulties or people who've had strokes or just older people who are struggling to eat. And Appetito deliver these, you know, this sort of food to your home. And it's a really fascinating issue, and it's a real growing problem as well.
Wow.
So a very diverse range of people today.
Quite different, yeah.
And then Vic Mystery, who's a good friend of mine, Vic from Ixion, I thought it'd be really good to find out about some more grant funding that's around.
Oh, cool.
Because
there
is lots. I'm going to cough now, actually, Paul.
Shall we have a listen to this then, so that you don't cough all over my microphone? Here, let's have a listen to this.
Been wandering around the Food Matters Live exhibition. It's here for 3 days. It's our first day, and I'm with Lucy, my producer. And lots of the exhibitors are doing really impressive, you know, research. And there's some great products here. And then we're wandering around, and we came across this stand. What did it look like, Lucy? Completely different from everybody else's.
It was very lab-like, wasn't it? It was a bit sciencey. There's quite a lot of science stuff over here, but there was sort of big containers with green stuff inside, which intrigued us.
So we wandered over, and we ended up talking to Stephen, who's come on the show for us now. And it's called Growing Underground. You've got a huge facility, don't know how you explain it, underground in Clapham in South West Fort. If anybody's in London, you would know what Clapham's like. And you're growing under the ground, like, I don't know, in some bunker or something. Describe to us exactly, I'll also just let you know that Stephen is a little bit mad. Describe to us exactly what you're doing and how on earth it started.
A little bit harsh on the mad, but anyway, we'll move past that. It started a few years back. My business partner came to me and we talked about vertical farming. And vertical farming, urban farming, becoming a bit of a big thing sort of around the world, and different people were doing it in different places. And then it was mainly in academia that they were saying it stacked up. And there was a book written by Professor Dixon Despommier that said about the vertical farm, and it was about using a small footprint of land within a city and growing right next to where the products are consumed, and mainly herbs and salads. It was a case of, okay, let's kind of, and this is literally drunken pub conversations.
Because you can't get much more local than doing that when you're growing stuff, can you?
There is no more local than that kind of production and consumption. And so we were talking about this, and then it came from my professional background prior to sort of starting this business, was about sort of building businesses that had profitable models. And so Richard and I then embarked on 2 years of business planning, which was understanding the selling price in the marketplace, as well as all the cost elements to it, and doing it in an office block didn't stack up financially.
And Richard is your drinking partner in the pub, I'm guessing. What's his full name?
Richard Ballard is actually my drinking / business partner, and now just business partner. And now all we talk about is work. So, And yeah, it was. It you start looking at the sort of cost of real estate in London at that time, even though it's still a recession. You're talking 60-180 quid a square foot, and so Richard from a previous project turned around and said, "Well, actually, I know about these tunnels and underneath." And so there's a section. They were all bought to air raid shelters. So and there's eight of them, spanning from Clapham South all the way through to Camden. And the one, for example, the one at Goodge Street, I think it is got the Beatles back catalogue hermetically sealed in there. So, and ours was an empty tunnel, and we approached TfL and said, "Look, we want to start a farm down there." And they looked at us like we were mental.
I mean, you must admit, you go to Transport for London, you know, where they're talking about tube trains and all that, and somebody like you rocks up and says, "I'd like to grow some veg in your tunnel." It doesn't. I mean, it's not the normal sort of conversation, is it?
No, we have many non-normal conversations. Yeah. But the thing is, people are like, you've got these empty tunnels. There was 8,000 people in our tunnel with 4,000 staff. You know, it's a big old lump. It's 70,000 square feet. It runs, as I said, all across London from Clapham South all the way through to Clapham North. To Camden. And so you've got these huge bits of space that are sat there. All right, some of them are being used for, one's a recording studio, one's got the Beatles back catalogue, etc. But the rest of them are just sat there. And apart from people saying, "I want to build a nightclub down there," and because of fire regulations, that's never going to happen. Transport for London were at a bit of a loss of what to do with them. So we said, "We want to build a farm." They looked at us like, "You're a bit mental." And then they gave us the keys. And we were like, "Okay, brilliant." And they've been super supportive in terms of rent-free periods, where as a start-up business, we're trying to get off the ground, etc., etc. And for a public body, certainly their property division has been very forward-thinking. So,
The thing that strikes me about the food sector, and we do meet a lot of producers and we see some amazing products, but I do worry about the financial model of some of these things because it's really, really overcrowded. And everybody says, "Oh, I've got the first gluten-free whatever," or, "Yeah, I've got crickets. Nobody else is doing crickets." Yeah, but I've spoke to 20 people that are, so you've probably got that wrong. Yeah. You've approached this from a business perspective, and what you've been doing is looking at what you can do that might satisfy some of your ethical, you know, background and considerations, but actually what is a profitable model? And it's to spend 2 years doing that and then going for it. I mean, that's how really, if you want to run a, don't want to say proper because that doesn't sound right, but if you want to run a really viable, sustainable, profitable business, that's what you need to do as opposed to a lifestyle business.
The guys around us, like, inevitably you wrap people around you that have got far better skills than you've got. And Richard and I come to it with no growing experience. Richard had an idea, and I got a business background. It was a case of, okay, we can, like... So Michel Roux Jr. joined our board just in terms of giving people that confidence that you're growing produce in the tunnel. People's experience of a tube tunnel is it's oily, dirt, and it's got rats in it. Obviously, you need to show that there are people that understand this is great produce. So Michel comes onto the board. We then wrapped great growers around us, and we wrapped people around us from the fresh produce industry, the managing director of Floret, the bag salad company. We took a corporate investment from G's Fresh, one of the biggest growers in the UK or in Europe. And the studies that I was doing or the analysis that I was doing, like, this came from the growers, and this goes back to your point, which when they came to us and said, "Look, if you're going to do this, you need to do it on a commercial scale. There isn't, otherwise we're messing about with a market garden kind of, you're never going to have any impact in terms of food production." And so what we were looking for was a space that would allow us to go to commercial scale. We thought that was an office block, didn't stack up financially. Look at a tunnel, it works. You start with a meter piece of growing equipment and stick a couple of LED lights over the top of it, you get great produce out. We moved to 100 square meters. We then went through a crowdfunding raised about 650,000-700,000 on Crowdcube. We then built the actual farm. We're now growing fresh produce that we supply into New Covent Garden Market at the margins that we were expecting to make in terms of our predictions. Obviously, some of the costs have gone up and down as we've gone through. But then now it's moving into the retail piece where you see the volume but smaller margins. But
if you're going to do the volume, you've got to have the investment, haven't you? And what I think is really difficult is when people are doing stuff on their kitchen table, literally, and then they're trying to scale up to the next level, it's not a slope, it's a big step. And there are big steps that you have to take. And as far as you're concerned, you know, growing produce like that, you're not going to make huge amounts of money or have a big business unless you do volume. And that's what you've gone for.
Yeah, you can take a couple of approaches to it. And our approach, our very raison d'etre to start with, was about using agricultural technology, and it was about use it to, one, to intensify yields and to make sure that we get as much as we can out of every square metre. But then in addition to that, it was doing it carbon neutrally. And we carbon account every last screw that goes into the farm. And then through afforestation and reforestation projects, in terms of our investment, that's how we offset at the end of the year. And we work with organisations to make sure that stands up to scrutiny. But it all comes back to, for us, it was three things. There was always three things. One, like, you're building a new business. You've got the luxury of building a new business. So you can say, right, okay, we can set the culture, tone, and what we feel, how we want to behave as a business. And we want to be socially, we want to engage. We want to engage with Lambeth Council and schools, education programmes, etc., etc. So you can actually engage with all of that from a social side. There was then the sustainability element as well. And it was the sustainability element was make sure that we do it carbon neutrally. And then there was a third piece as well, which was we wanted to show for our investors that there was a return for investing in sustainability. Because that's when we're going to change things. You know, when the city realises that they can make money from sustainability, then we're not going to have, like, that. You look at sort of 30% of the FTSE counts as assets in carbon. Like, we've got a sustainability issue that's going to come and hit us, and that sustainability issue, like, we can argue about prices of oil and when it's going to run out, etc., etc. I think we can all agree it's going to run out at some stage. Do you know what I mean? And you can frack and you can do Shell, etc.
It's just when, isn't it?
It's just a case of when. And some people will argue, we've reached peak oil and then we're going to have these challenges. And so we said, okay, we will base our business on a sustainable model that, like, you future-proof it by, we buy all of our energy from good energy in Chippenham and we get it from solar PV and wind. Like, why would you not do that? Do you know what I mean? That's just a logical way of setting up a business these days. And then also setting the right social values as well as setting the right financial goals as well.
And as you said, if you start a new business, you do have the luxury, first of all, having the time to try and decide what you're going to do all those processes, get all those people around you, and you can set it up as you want. It's quite difficult, isn't it, to model, take something and then try and change something that it takes forever. I mean, the luxury of a new business for you guys is putting in place all those things that you want.
That was my past. My past was working for a PLC, the distribution PLC. Fantastic company. However, their approach to sustainability as a PLC was about making sure that their customers kind of thought they were doing the right thing and that their shareholders weren't spending too much cash on it and getting the right dividends. Our values differed in a way, whereas I thought that they could have taken a much stronger approach to sustainability and actually use that as a marketing tool as well. But if people don't give a damn about sustainability and the environment, then they can just build whatever business they like. And I would just hope to think that the millennials that are coming through and people that are starting businesses these days, I think sustainability is just a given for these guys now.
It's interesting you mentioned millennials, because as you were speaking, I'm thinking, if millennials are your, you know, target market, you're going to have that stuff in there because that's what they're looking for, and it is just, you know, it's just normal. And if you haven't got it, they'll just go somewhere else. And that's a generation for me who really are thinking about what they're buying and what their money, where their money goes, and what they're spending it on is quite important to them.
I recently had a conversation with one of the higher end retailers in London, and they're specifically lent towards organics, and like the number of, like, the biggest purchaser that they've got is students. Like, one of the biggest demographics is students, and they'll go in and it's small purchases, but it's small regular purchases. It's not like going and do a weekly shop, but they were going in the small regular, and I was baffled that it was students and millennials that are moving through. And that's just a given in terms of their purchase. Now, I will not for one second pretend that I know what millennials are thinking or what they're thinking of in terms of technology, but these guys are the futures in terms of purchasing. And I think sustainability, if you're not sustainable, they're going to walk on by. And I don't want to get to a stage where people are being sustainable just because they can attack the millennial market. If that's not ingrained and given and inside of you, you're going to get found out anyway.
You've got to be authentic. And social media now makes sure you're authentic, because trust me, you will get found out if you're not.
Do not look at my social media feed. It's very authentic.
Of course it is. So in terms of growing underground, where can people actually find your products, or are you just selling into sort of wholesale and distributors?
So we put it into New Covent Garden and the food service distributor, so all chefs can access it from there, and the chefs, the contract caterers, etc., etc. We did a piece with Compass and the Levy Restaurant guys and Baxter Story, and doing a piece with Sodexo in terms of Chelsea Flower Show as well. And so I do that kind of end user piece by talking to the contract caterers as well as the distribution guys out there. We also put it into Ted's Veg down at New Covent Garden Market, only because they're lovely. So we put it down into Borough Market, and because it's got like, it's that foodie market, and it's a bit touristy these days, but you know what I mean. And then we put it through Farm Drop as well, in terms of an online offer where people can purchase the product. But again, that's more of a foodie kind of, you know, like small producers. The next step for us is, like we said right at the start of the conversation, it's that scale and it's retail, and that's coming up in early January.
Well, how exciting is that? So if anybody wants to know more about you, Growing Underground, what's your website?
Website is www.growingunderground.com, and yeah, I won't give out my Twitter feed because there's some really offensive comments.
Deary me. Okay. Well, Growing Underground, we love it, and check out the website, and Stephen Dring, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I'm joined by Lee Shepherd of Appetito, and I have his business card in front of me, and it has the rather long and very important title of Director of Public Policy and External Affairs, which you can hardly fit on his business card. You're from Appetito, and I know you've got other brands like Wiltshire Farm Foods. How long have you been there, Lee?
I've been at Appetito now for 20 years. It's a real man and boy story, I think.
Man and boy story. And I believe that you started off and you've got quite a lot of experience of care homes and things like that as a background.
Yeah, I joined the business many years ago as an accountant, but my life has sort of moved on since then. So I've spent 8 years setting up and running Appetito's care homes division. So probably spent time in over 400 care homes in the UK. So it's a market I think I know quite well.
You know quite well. And we were talking earlier about my mother. So and I was saying to you that she's obviously got some problems swallowing. She's getting older. She's 77. She's not that old. It's really affecting her sort of social life. So we're not going out to restaurants now, not because she's embarrassed about going to the loo and being sick or something, but actually we're spending all this money on a lovely food and she can't eat it. You know, it's a waste of time. And she can cook, so she's cooking sort of softer food like salmon and things like that. But that's actually quite common. I thought it was an unusual thing, but it's quite a common thing, isn't it?
Yeah, we were talking earlier. We think there are probably about 4 million people in the UK that have problems with chewing or swallowing. So it's a condition called dysphagia. It needs to be diagnosed by a healthcare professional, but we see an increasing amount of it both in the community, in healthcare, in care homes, and it's where people need the texture of their food modified in some way just to make it easier for them to chew and swallow.
And the result of this, it could be because of a stroke, it could just be age. You know, why do we start to have difficulty eating, you know, what I would call normal food?
Yeah, but a whole series of conditions. So it can be just general getting older, so muscles weakening, so the chewing and swallowing reflex weakens. So it can be age-related, but it's associated with a huge number of conditions as well. So about 40% of people that have had a stroke will end up with a swallowing difficulty. People with dementia, about 70% of people with dementia in care homes will have a swallowing difficulty. People neurological conditions, so motor neurone, conditions like multiple sclerosis, head and neck cancers, a whole series of sort of medical conditions are likely to generate a swallowing difficulty.
And food, on the Food Talk show, we love food. Obviously, we have people who show us truffles and caviar and amazing ham and cheese. And for me, food is a really life-enhancing thing. It's part of the, you know, centre of your social life. Often you have friends round and food is on the middle of the table and you're sharing. It's a really difficult thing to lose, isn't it? That ability to join in and eat, you know, normal food in a normal way. The thought of it for me is quite depressing, that actually in the end I might end up just having pureed mush.
Yeah, I think the reality is for a lot of people that they do end up having pureed mush. So they end up with a condition, as we said, called dysphagia. And there are different categories of food and texture that they will need depending on their condition. And it's not well understood. The reality is most people with a dysphagia are living at home. and they're aware of their condition. Maybe, you know, they know they've had a stroke. They know that they're struggling to eat. You know, it's become more difficult to swallow. But they don't really know what to do in terms of food. So they end up, you know, by trial and error, you know, maybe they're looking like your mum for some softer food. But the condition is often progressive, so it can become worse. And then they end up trying to blend that food. And they, you know, they don't know what they're doing. So, and I've seen this even in care as well, where the meat, the potato, the veg is being put in a blender. And that always comes out as a grey, green mush.
Really unappetising. And if you're trying to get better and you need good food, that's going to put you off eating, isn't it?
It is. You know, we all, you know, food is, we don't just eat food as people for fuel. You know, we eat food for enjoyment. We want to be stimulated to enjoy our food. And regardless of what condition you're in, nobody wants to be presented with something that looks like, well, frankly, something that you probably wouldn't feed your dog.
And I'm trying to understand what Appetito do. So you'll actually blend the food, but you won't blend it how we do it at home. It would be highly blended. And then how do you make it appetizing? How do you make it into something that looks solid?
So we're supplying a range of pureed meals, and this is what we're talking about, food that's been pureed. And as we said before, this will end up as blobs on a plate from most people and most care providers. What we have is a process that we spent about 2 years investing in this range and developing the techniques around it. So I'm not an engineering expert, but we have a very complex blender system that effectively, if you're looking for a pureed meal, it needs to be completely smooth with no bits. The reality is home blenders don't do that. You'll know yourself. You end up with some smooth bits, some lumps. But with dysphagia, that's not just about the meal not being sort of to your taste. It can actually be dangerous and can cause a risk of choking. So we have very highly complex equipment that gets the right texture. And then using natural starches within the food, we're then able to reform that carrot or whatever. So we're using carrots like you and I would do at home. But that then carrot is then formed into a shape where it looks like a carrot, which obviously makes it visually appealing. One of the key challenges with people suffering with dementia is that they look for food that they recognise. So if I'm to give somebody blobs on a plate and tell them that that's a steak pie, then clearly they look at it and think, well, that's not a steak pie. I'm not eating that. And that's one of the key challenges. So this food they recognise, and it just looks far more appealing. You know, we all want to eat with dignity. Like you've said, your mum, she stopped going out. You know, this is not an end of life condition. These are people across all ages, you know, including children. And they want to eat with dignity. They want to be able to go out with friends and not feel embarrassed about the food that they're eating.
So you'll take a carrot, you'll take all the nutrition, everything there is in a carrot, you'll puree it in a way that you couldn't possibly achieve at home, and then you will form it into what looks like a carrot, so that even when you cook it, whether it's in the oven or the microwave, it doesn't then disappear into a lump. It actually stays as a carrot and it looks like a carrot, and that person can then eat that quite safely knowing it's going to be okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we do very well is that there are other companies out there that will make pureed food, and in a frozen form, it will look appealing. It will have a texture. It will have a shape to it. The reality is, when it's cooked, it then just breaks down and becomes a blob on a plate. And you know, it's no good having food in its packaged state that looks good. It needs to look good when it's in front of the individual.
And are you finding that obviously when people are elderly that they really do want to stay at home, and essentially they might not be able to order on the internet, or I'm sure you've got lots of ways of ordering, but you've actually got their children doing that and making sure that they're okay. And there's some great technology around as well at the moment, isn't there, to encourage people to stay at home so that you can monitor whether they've come downstairs in the morning, you know, that they're all right. How do you, as part of your company, how do you make sure that these people are eating this stuff and that they're okay? Do you feel that's part of your role?
Yeah, I think that, as we spoke earlier, with health and social care changing, the reality is home is the default position for care for our generation. When you look at malnutrition statistics in the UK, 93% of people with malnutrition are at home. They're not in care homes, they're not in hospital. And with funding for social care being cut further and further, people have to stay at home. It's also where they want to be. We talk, you know, people want to stay at home for as long as they can. So it's not just being about somebody that provides food. It's that whole service around it. Many of our orders through Wiltshire Farm Foods are placed by family members wanting to make sure that the mum, dad, auntie or whatever are getting the nutrition that they need. So the whole service package around delivering the meal, somebody to come in, do a health and wellbeing check, make sure that that Doris is okay, to check the freezer, make sure that, you know, not only she ordered 7 meals in the last week, but that she's actually also eaten 7 meals in the last week, is becoming increasingly important.
And the feeling that this might happen to me, you know, that somehow I can't enjoy food, which is a big part of my life. This is going to be something that is going to increase in the future, isn't it? That we're going to have to look at how we help people eat at home and eat well at home. And it's only going to increase.
Yeah, I think if you look back 20 years, you know, we had geriatric wards in hospitals. Many of the people in care homes were living there on a sort of residential basis. The reality is now it's care homes are more focused on nursing needs. So we're living at home, you know, with more and more conditions that maybe challenge our diet. So, you know, that concept of specialist nutrition is there at home and becoming increasingly important. And we talked about the puree food earlier. You know, it's one thing putting food in a blender so it's puree and it's thin enough to eat. When you put that food in a blender, it congeals together. So what most people do is then say, look, I need to add some water to this. Well, then you dilute the nutrition. And somebody with dysphagia doesn't tend to eat well because it's difficult. What they're then eating is food that's got no nutritional value. So actually, they're starting to become malnourished. So the food that you supply them has got to be the right texture, but it's got to be high in nutrition. And I think that's what we do really well. All our meals would have over 500 calories, 20 grams of protein. So they're supporting recovery as well as being appealing to eat.
And as a family member, you know then that they're getting everything that they need. It's absolutely fascinating, and I'm sure we're going to hear more and more about this. So Lee Shepherd of Appetito and also Wiltshire Farm Foods, Director of Public Policy and External Affairs. Great title. Thank you for joining me, Lee.
Thanks very much. Take care.
Wow.
It's an important topic, isn't it?
It is. It is. I mean, two very, very dialectically opposed kind of things going on there. First and foremost, the underground stuff is brilliant, isn't it? We were discussing this earlier, that the amount of abandoned tunnels and things under London. Many years ago, a company called Colt, which was City of London Telecom, they appropriated a lot of tunnels and laid fibre optic cables in there for the banking industry's technology.
It's all those Victorian engineers, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
All these... all these tunnels, you're coughing now.
It's spread to
all
me
these,
now.
All these tunnels under the ground. Fascinating.
But Appetito is something I'd never heard of. I wasn't aware of that as an issue.
It's a huge company.
And clearly it is a big issue. Mm. Fascinating topic in terms of how they've addressed that issue and moving from just, you know, feeding adults baby food, basically.
Nobody wants to eat.
Mm.
So I've got another one for you here, and this is Vic from Ixion, and he's a bit of an expert on grant funding. And one of the things I get asked for in my day job is, there seems to be all these government grants, but I don't know how to access them.
What's
happening with European grants now because of Brexit? And Vic's our expert.
Should we have a listen to what Vic's got to say? Let's do that.
I'm with Vic Mistry, and I've known Vic for a little while, actually, and our paths have crossed in business a few times. He's with Ixion Holdings, and he leads the innovation partnership team. Now, why would that be of interest to food companies or anybody interested in food, you might say? Well, I can tell you that on the show, we see huge amounts of innovation, really interesting stuff that people are trying to look at ingredients, how they increase the shelf life of ingredients, even though they're trying not to add, you know, artificial flavourings or colourings or any of that stuff. And we're also seeing some amazing stuff in terms of sourcing ingredients and lots of things to do with the Internet of Things and all sorts of things. So, you know, food innovation for me is really interesting, and actually people are innovating more and more in the sector. My particular area of expertise is research and development tax relief, which sounds really boring, but for anybody who's innovating, there's a lot of money sitting waiting there to be had from the government. But the person who's a real expert is Vic Mistry, because he knows all these European stuff that's around, all the other sorts of funding that the British government would have. And I'm going to ask him today if he can help us through a few sample things that perhaps food companies or people in food might be able to apply for. So, hi, Vic. Haven't seen you for a while.
Good afternoon to you, Sue. How are you today?
Yeah, Very good, very good. So I'm into food. Can you tell me some of the maybe three or four things at the moment that you're quite excited by that you can help people apply for in terms of funding?
Absolutely. And one of the key things within the food sector that there are key issues are things like smarter packaging to enable the shelf life of food. They're looking at precision engineering, robotics in farming, using satellites for crops. They also look at things along the lines of tackling obesity for children, aquaculture, but also looking at modern methods of food manufacturing. So there's so much money available for organisations in this space. What Ixion can really do and add value is we work with ambitious, innovative organisations and win major grant funding for them. Now, grant funding could be anything from, say, 50k right up to 10 million euro, depending upon what it is that they want to develop. They can develop a concept, they can develop a prototype, or there's money available for commercialization. But the difficulty is accessing these grants, and that's something that we can enable organizations to support with.
I think so many people will moan about, you know, European funding or government grants in that they seem to deliberately make it really, really difficult. And I'm sure that's not the case. But the problem with government funding is they have to be accountable. And of course, you know, the Sun or the Daily Mail or something would be right on it if somebody's, you know, got £1 million worth of government funding and then, of course, have done something bad with it or run off with it. And therefore, to safeguard themselves of being accused of that, there's all these sort of things around it to make sure that it's all bona fide and it's going to be okay. The real problem with that, of course, is that when you're an SME, it feels almost impossible to navigate. So somebody like Ixion, would they literally really come along and just take it off your plate for you?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm glad that you mentioned that, Sue. Grant funding is a complex, difficult, onerous, bureaucratic administrative exercise.
You like it a lot then, do you?
Absolutely. We don't expect SMEs or even large enterprises to this matter to actually go down that process and access these grants. What Ixion actually does was we actually take care of everything for our clients. We validate the concept, we identify the right funding body that's suitable for their project.
So that's interesting. So if I'm let's say developing some new type of farming or some robotics and looking at new ingredients, I could come to somebody like you and say, I'm doing this. Tell me, Vic, is there anything out there for me? I mean, you know, can you actually do that?
Yes, absolutely. One of the key things that we do is before we engage with an organisation, we need to ensure that their project idea fits with the necessary funding calls that are out there. So the validation of project ideas is so important, because otherwise what's the point of submitting a project bid when their project idea doesn't fit with the call?
So it's just going to fail, and you're not going to waste your time doing that, are you?
No, absolutely not. You know, our role is to put together unrejectable bids to these grant funding bodies, and that could be through Innovate UK or the European Commission's Horizon 2020 programme, and there's specific key areas within food that they'll fund.
And if you go forward in some of these grant funding, how does that work? Do you actually get money for you to do some development work, or do you have to find what's called match funding, where, you know, you might get £50,000 but you've got to find £50,000 yourself? I know there's lots of different types of funding, but what's the general rule of thumb?
Okay, grant funding they will not fund 100% of projects, only if it's within the healthcare space, looking at clinical or preclinical trials. But what they will typically fund is feasibility studies, industrial development, and also commercialization. So depending upon where you are at in your development strategy, so say for example, if you're looking to prove a concept, there's funds available for that, and that could be, depending upon the size of the business, it could be 70%, it could be 60%, it could also be 50%. It all depends upon the size of the business and the intervention rates that the funding bodies are offering to that specific course. So, for example, with the European Commission's Horizon 2020 programme, they'll fund 70% of your project costs with 25% overhead. So, you know, almost 95% of your project costs could be covered, but they will not fund 100%. But to answer your question, you know, you need to have skin in the game. So they always encourage organisations to see whether they've got either got money in the bank or they're going to receive further investment from a VC or some form of.
So they want to see that you've got commitment to it as well. So,
yeah.
So they won't fund 100%. But blimey, 70%. I mean, if you're going to do that anyway, getting 70% of that is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a great way of offsetting the risk of new product development. Product development is very, very risky, but if we can access grants, and the key benefits of grant funding is there's no dilution of equity, you don't have to pay the money back. We at Ixion are probably one of the most successful organisations in Europe in accessing grants, purely on the basis that we're very, very selective with the companies that we work with. But also, you know, we've got to do the due diligence up front to ensure that the project ideas fit with what the funding bodies are looking for.
So, if I am developing something amazing, and we see lots of amazing things on this programme, what's the best thing to do? Can we just go on the website, or can somebody, you know, email somebody just to say, I've got this, can I just chat it through? Because you don't want to go for all that stuff and then obviously you don't get it, and I can see that would waste your time. So where do I start if I'm embarking on something incredible?
The first thing to do is to obviously contact myself. I can give you my email address, my contact details. You can either go through the website or you can go through one of my colleagues that is based at head office. But ideally, I'd prefer you to contact myself initially. I can give you my details.
What we'll do is we'll put them on the Food Talk website. So if anybody's listening and they're really interested in what Vic's saying, and just have a look at the range of funding that's available, it does make your head spin a bit. And I get a little bit upset because some of these funds don't actually go out because people don't apply for them, which is it's terrible, isn't it? I mean, that's a terrible thing. So we'll make sure those contact details are there.
No, thank you very much. And it is frustrating, but please, whoever's listening out there, if you've got really good projects where you feel that grant funding can benefit your business, it's a great way. It's the most powerful form of business capital.
And as you say, you're not giving any shares, any equity away, and you don't have to pay the money back, so it's not a loan either.
Absolutely not. It's a grant. You don't have to pay it back. But more importantly, it's really, really difficult to access these grants. And we're here to support organisations in accessing those grants, so it's effectively taking the burden away from you. You know, we work in partnership with our clients. For example, you know, most recently, we won a project 15 out of 15. It's totally unheard of. It's a 5 million euro project, totally unheard of. We're very proud of that. But you know, it took us 18 months to put the project bid together, so it's either you get it or your competitors get it. It's as simple as that.
Well, that's really enlightening. Thank you so much for joining us, Vic. And as we say, we'll put all that detail on the foodtalk.co.uk website. Thanks for joining us.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
That was interesting and fascinating. You're absolutely right, and Vic was absolutely right. There are so many of these opportunities around, and it's just almost impossible to get on top of it and
trying to
understand it and do the right thing. I was involved at the back end of last year with a government, with the old BIS department, and I took part in a thing with them in looking at why there isn't more take up for these grants.
Because they make it so blooming difficult. That's
exactly.
Why.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't
Who's
rocket
got
science.
Time? I mean, have you ever run a business? Then you'd know that it's hard enough just getting every day done, let alone sitting writing reams and reams and reams of forms that
absolutely
that small businesses just don't understand. And I think it's great. Somebody like Vic and Ixion. Ring them up, ask them, they'll help you. And I think that's a great offer.
Absolutely,
They'll be able to tell you. And if they can help you, they will. And if they can't, they'll say.
So. Absolutely. And it's such a shame that there are so many businesses looking for capital, looking to do things, and either don't know that these grants exist or, as you say, are put off because it's just so difficult.
Yeah.
Cool.
We're going to start a little bit lighter. We have a bit of a heavy session, haven't we, for this programme? But all interesting stuff.
Hey, it's everything. You get everything on the Food Talk show. There's no holding back here.
Still about food, though.
Yeah.
I met this lady. This product, I've got it at home. I've got three. I bought three packets. It's called Sugar Vida. I don't like sugar. You don't like sugar.
No, that's true.
I don't like, have a spoonful of sugar. Mm-hmm. Isn't that Mary Poppins? Help the medicine.
Yeah,
sugar.
Yeah, something like that.
A spoonful of sugar. I can't think of anything worse. This sugar tastes amazing. It tastes delicious. It's almost like malt.
Right.
Malty flavour.
And it's from, well, she's going to tell you all about it. Mm. It's a nutritional sugar. She found it in India and she's packaged it up. It's the only sugar that I like. You can bake with it, put it in tea, you know, all the stuff that you would normally do, but it's gorgeous.
Okay, well, let's hear what she's got to say, and then I've got some questions about that.
Yeah,
but she might answer them anyway.
After that, we're talking to Boca Foods about traffic light labelling system. But listen to this about Sugar Vida.
Okay, cool.
I'm with Lucy, the producer of the Food Talk Show. I've got a story to tell you, Lucy. I went out with my best mate, Lasty, last night. Her name's Lasty. And we had a bottle of wine between us. It wasn't too bad, but she was driving, so she only had one glass. I did have the rest. Anyway, I went home and I was told to take a teaspoon of this product I've got in front of me before I went to bed. And that if I did that, I would sleep really, really well for 8 hours. I don't know why, I can't remember now. And I'd feel amazing in the morning. It would sort of ameliorate some of those effects from having a few glasses of wine.
Yeah.
Mm. I haven't slept for 8 hours for, I would say 3 or 4 months. Weather's been bad, and I don't know,
storms,
busy at work, all sorts of things. Anyway, lo and behold, I had 8 hours sleep last night.
Really?
Yeah. So whether it's this product or whether it was a psychological effect, I don't know. But would you like to know what it was?
I would, yes, please. Mm.
It's called Sugar Vida, and it's organic, I don't even know how you pronounce it, Palmyra tree blossom sugar, which I don't even know what that is, and it just seemed to work.
Mm, I think I'll have to get myself some.
Yeah, so we might want to try some.
Stop those 3 o'clock wake-ups.
I know. I've got it in front of me. It's got a Great Taste 2-star award, which is actually pretty difficult to get. Mm. And I've also got Christina Locke in front of me. Christina, what is this product that we have in front of us? This super amazing product, which I don't know whether it's psychological or not, but it did it for me last night.
Well, it's called Sugar Vida, and actually it's the nectar of the Palmyra tree. Now, this is a tree that grows in southeast India, and it's been revered for 5,000 plus years in Ayurvedic medicine, which is the healing system of medicine of India. So it has been used medicinally for all of its wonderful properties. And
Is it a sugar?
Yes, it is a nutritional sugar.
Well, we've got some in front of me, got a packet in front of me, and I think it has the most amazing taste. I don't like sugar, refined white sugar. Don't even really like Demerara sugar, any of those. This is a sugar, it's slightly powdery, and it tastes amazing. Do you want to taste some, Lucy? Because I'm sort of now rather converted to this, I had a teaspoon of that in my tea this morning. Can you smell it?
Yeah,
do you want to describe it? Lovely is not a good description on the radio, Lucy.
We know that I love the word lovely. It's got a really nice smell. It's like a caramel malt.
Malty.
Yeah.
Slightly smells.
I don't think if I would like it in tea because I don't like the sweet tea. Coffee,
It's not sweet though. It's not sweet. I wouldn't say it was. How would you describe it? How would you describe it, Christina?
I would. Well, some people call it, say, malt tone. Some people say it has a hint of coffee. Some people has a hint of chocolate. And it's sort of all of those tastes and flavors mixed with a brown sugar molasses flavor, caramel, sort of toffee.
It's not a big hit sugar, though.
No. It's not a massive. If I was to do that with white caster sugar, I'd be putting all sorts of faces at you now. But I didn't expect it to, because it's quite powdery as you put it on the spoon, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's actually got a really nice texture. You can taste the granules in it. But it's really nice.
Yeah, I don't even know how to describe it.
And it dissolves instantly as well. But for me, you're absolutely right. Coffee is coffee and hot chocolate, really, in terms of the beverages, and obviously the turmeric lattes, which are very big at the moment. Golden milks, those are the three best, you know, brothers and sisters to have with it. It's fantastic in those three drinks particularly.
So tell me how it's harvested, and you said it's the Palmyra tree in southern India. So explain how it's actually made.
Okay, so these are trees that we only wild harvest, so that's a key thing. We never cut down a tree. It is a type of palm tree, but remember there are over 100 different types of palm trees. So unfortunately, you know, you get people saying, oh, is this palm sugar? Well, palm sugar is really coconut palm sugar, and there are another 10 or 12 different types. But again, with all of these things, it's down to the nutritional profile, it's down to where it's grown, and the terroir. You know, like good wine, you know, what's the soil it grows in, what are the microbes around it. And so I'll come back to the process in just a second. Okay. But what makes this unique about it, it has over 15 vitamins and minerals in very high amounts, particularly the B vitamins and the B12. It's one of the only plant-based sources that we know of. So if you're vegan, vegetarian, it's absolutely essential. And
not something you would ever say about sugar, though, is it? I mean, sugar to me is just unnecessary, actually. I don't know whether it is, but it feels like it's unnecessary. And this is actually, weirdly, a health product, a natural health product.
Yeah. But let's again, you know, I'm not going to go too down the technical, but we need sugars to survive. We don't survive without them. It's all about the quality, and it's about the dosage. How much do we have? The thing is, when we're eating something that is real food, that has real vitamins and real minerals, we don't need a lot of it. It satiates us. And this will also wake up your natural leptin response. So it means you feel full and satisfied when you eat this. You cannot binge on this, even if you try. And trust me, I've tried.
So it's got all these lovely 15 vitamins and minerals, even though it's a sugar. It's low GI. And I hear that it's diabetic friendly. How is that possible if it's in inverted commas a sugar?
Okay. Well, this is a very interesting area, and we are actually in the middle of doing some studies on diabetics, because what we see, yes, it's low GI, so obviously it's going to keep your blood sugar very stable when using it. But what we are also seeing over time of use, blood glucose levels are dropping.
And so counterintuitive.
And it is. And this is what's baffling a lot of people, because they say, well, this is a carbohydrate, it's a sugar, how can it do all these things? It has these wonderful compounds in it. And that's why, you know, that's why the Ayurvedic doctors knew, you know, and have been using it and prescribing it for all these, because they knew that it had all these wonderful qualities.
And Ayurvedic medicine from India is really the basis of everything being balanced out. So that you have a diet that's got, you know, yogurt versus, you know, carbohydrates versus proteins, and it's about making sure it's balanced. Is that right?
Yeah, it's about a balanced diet for your body type, and there are three different body types: the kapha, Vata and Pita, but that's another conversation.
Right, so tell me which one I am.
No, I'll get you.
Okay.
You can't do it in a 2 minute.
That's all right, that's all the way. Fat bottom equals, you know, whatever. So we're saying about the Ayurvedic medicine, it's about this, all these, it's balance. Yeah. Sorry, my bottom distracted you then.
It did. but obviously, it's to do with diet, it's also herbs. Different types of treatments. You know, you can extend it and also include meditation and yoga in for the physical practices.
A real holistic approach, isn't it?
Holistic.
I mean, a proper holistic approach.
Absolutely. And again, it all comes down, the balance is really important, because it's about having all the different tastes when we eat. So we have the sweet, we have the salty, we have the astringent, we have the bitter.
Which, and let's face it, Indian cooking is so good at.
That is true, but you see what happens here, we go into the two extremes of salty or sweet. We don't eat enough of the other elements, which are essential. So absolutely, in the Ayurvedic way of looking at things, you know, a little bit of sweet is important. We have to have it for health and for maintenance of good health.
Well, I have actually had a teaspoon of that in my tea this morning, and I didn't actually find it too sweet, and I don't like sweet things. And I'm definitely going to have another little teaspoon tonight before I go to bed. No, I'm not drinking. No, I'm not drinking tonight, because I really want to see if I will get another good night's sleep. So I would highly recommend it. It's called Sugavida, which is spelled Sugavida. And can you tell us where we can find it? Where can I buy it from? Have you got a website and all that sort of stuff?
So we've literally just launched it. So You can go to our website, sugarvita.co.uk and .com. On Amazon, you can find us, natural health food stores, Whole Foods, Planet Organic, Revital, and hopefully watch this space, more national retailers coming in the very near future.
Well, Lucy and I travel around to these exhibitions and we interview an awful lot of producers. This actually is different, yeah. Which is quite hard to say in this space, isn't it, at the moment. So for me, it is a really different product and I would recommend it. Got to taste it. It's got an interesting taste profile. So, so there we go. So thank you very much. Thank you very much to Christina. Look out for it, Sugar Vida.
Thank you.
I'm with Franco Beer, who's from Bocca Food, and we've been having a bit of a discussion about the traffic light labelling system. And I'm sure everybody's aware of it. It's the sort of round circles that you get on food, and then the first one normally tells you how many calories are in it, although I think everybody knows what I think about calories, a load of rubbish. And then it tells you about how much fat, how much saturates, how much sugars, how much salt. And it's a very good visual way, just very quickly, to be able to see, you know, what the health benefits of a product. I know that most supermarkets take it on. There's one big exception to that, I think. Why they're dragging their feet, I do not know. It's an important signal, isn't it, for the public, Franco, in terms of when they're trying to make quick decisions when they go out shopping.
Yeah, I really believe in them because it's a really easy, simple way to understand what you're buying. And, you know, we all know green is good and red is bad and amber is somewhere in the middle, I guess. So it's really important for us. It's a very quick way of being able to tell, make a decision.
And most foods that you buy will have at least an amber in there somewhere and sometimes a red, because each food is a balance of something. So if you eat cheese, then obviously the old fat bit's going to have red on it, but the sugars will be, you know, green and whatever. And if you're having other stuff like fruit, obviously the sugars will be perhaps amber or red, but the fat and salt will be sort of low. But it does allow you to make those judgments. But it's almost impossible to get all green, isn't it?
It is obviously this.
Unless you're eating spinach, probably.
Yeah, unless you're eating spinach. I mean, the thing is, it is difficult. And what I like about it, and I think it works really well when it's applied to the food that's prepared, that's made, that you buy. But in terms of, you know, fruit and veg, obviously it doesn't apply to that. But it is difficult, particularly in confectionery. If you're looking at confectionery, you're looking at, you know, cereal bars, you know, is obviously where what we're in. It is very difficult to find. Well, we are the only all green traffic light cereal bar around at the moment. It took a long time to develop, and you know, we believe we're innovators, and this is what it takes. And you know, cereal bars have been a particular bugbear of mine because most people assume cereal bars are healthy. Of course, you know, we know they're not really.
Stuff full of sugar. So I'm looking at your products here. We've got three cereal bars, and every single one has just got green traffic lights all over them, which is an astonishing achievement, frankly. And as you said, when you've got fresh food, of course you've got stuff that's been dug out of the ground, then you don't need to traffic light that. But when you are putting you know, prepared foods together, it's really, really hard and getting that balance right. So I'm intrigued that we have a caramel cereal bar, strawberry cereal bar, apple cereal bar, and they're all green. I'm now going to do the taste test, though, Franco, because to be honest, you know, it all looks amazing, but it's the taste that counts. So while I'm doing that, just explain to me how you started the company and what drove you to do that. There's always a story behind these passions that people have.
Yeah, that's very true. I've always been passionate about cereal bars, and I always wanted to produce a cereal bar going back, I don't know, 6 years ago. This particular journey started 2.5 years ago in development. I had a friend of mine who is a very good food technologist, and he actually introduced the first chewy cereal bar into the UK in the 80s for Quaker. My background's food development, and I used to be a chef. And so together I said, look, I want to produce a proper healthy but tasty cereal bar, because the taste is most important, you're going to help me. So we spent 2.5 years. We got a patent on the syrup, the binding technology that delivers the green traffic lights. And that's really how it came about. We launched in July this year, touch wood, they've been incredibly well received. And now we're just, you know, sort of pushing ahead. We've had lots of interest. It's been a labour of love. And we're just about to launch an all-green traffic light granola as well, which is based on the bars.
Well, I've just tasted the cereal one and the apple one. And they do taste really nice. Like you've passed the taste test here, Franco. What I really like about them is more and more people are having breakfast on the go, and it is difficult to choose something that is, well, not full of sugar, as far as I'm concerned, and I don't like the sugar much at all. The caramel bar is lovely, and it's got a crunchiness, but it's that binding agent. I'm really interested in that, because most of it is... It's either really chewy or, I mean, you just had a taste, haven't you, Lucy? Mm. Whereas this, it feels natural. It feels like you might have made it yourself at home and then, you know, put it together.
That's exactly what I was just thinking. It's sweet enough, but it's not too... There's some cereal bars and you'll eat them and you'll almost feel the sugar going straight into your teeth. But it just feels and tastes really natural, and it's a really nice balance, like for the flavour, especially the apple and cinnamon and the caramel.
And very high in fibre.
Mm. Exactly. I'd happily have that on the go.
Yeah, I might actually. Franco's got a few in front of him. I might steal those and have one for breakfast tomorrow. But where can people find them? So Bocca is spelt Bokka. These are Bocca bars. Where would I be able to find them if I want to get a load in for breakfast?
Best place is to go to our website, which is bockafood.co.uk. As I said earlier, we initially launched in food services, but we have had lots of inquiry from major supermarkets here at Food Matters Live, which is great. And so we will see, you know, we will eventually be in there sometime in the spring, but the cheapest place to get them will be online.
And don't forget, Bocca is spelt Bokka. Well, thank you very much, Franco. That's really good. I'm going to stuff some of those in my bag.
Should we buy a box?
We might have to buy a box and maybe put them in the office. But thanks very much and very good luck with it.
Thank you very much, Amy. Thank you. Thank you.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah, following on from that, there's been some news today coming out from Nestle. You know Nestle, don't you?
I do indeed. Kit Kat. Yeah, yeah.
Lots of other things. And they've just said they've made a scientific breakthrough that can sharply cut the sugar in its chocolate.
Wow.
And they've actually patented it.
Wow.
Now, there's a double-edged sword with patenting, isn't there? Because if you patent it, you tell all your rivals about it.
Yeah.
But they must have got this patent, and they're going to go for it. And apparently they found a way to structure sugar differently so that it uses 40% less in their chocolate, which is quite a lot. And there's going to be a sugar tax, presumably. Yeah, absolutely. They're saying it tastes the same, and they say they're going to start using this new sugar across the whole range from 2018.
Wow.
So it's obviously a very big development.
Absolutely.
And it's altered the structure of the sugar so that it sort of dissolves more quickly,
right,
and it fools your taste buds into thinking it's sweeter than it is.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, and they're saying it's truly groundbreaking research. So that's going to be
interesting.
Sounds
like molecular manipulation. Mm. I mean, it's good if they can pull that off. I mean, every little helps. I'm not a big sugar fan, and I know you're not, Sue. So. Luckily, I don't have a sweet tooth. So, if they can do that, that will make significant.
Well, with the sugar tax, they're all putting a bit more effort, aren't they?
Well, exactly.
To cutting down sugar. So maybe we're going to see a few more of these developments because you know, people don't want to affect the taste, do they? That's the issue. So maybe they're not looking so much at recipes, but maybe new types of science and research and development to help.
Absolutely, and it would be really nice if this technology, assuming that it works, and there's no reason why it shouldn't work, I guess, if they've patented it. But if they could use that in other products, not just chocolates and sweeties, because as we know, sugar is in almost everything you consume if it's a processed food.
Yeah, even bread, which you wouldn't think, but it is.
Exactly, yeah.
So a very diverse programme this week.
Indeed it was, Very interesting. Loads of different things being discussed, from underground growing to grants.
And I'm a bit missing a few things to eat in the studio, though. So I think we ought to have some more guests next week, don't you?
Yeah, withdrawal symptoms.
Yeah, I know you're on a diet and you're always saying that. But actually, I think we should get some people in next week and start, as we're getting up to Christmas, start getting some food out here. And,
maybe we could get some diety things.
Not before Christmas.
Do you know any avocado growers? I'm heavily into eating avocados
at
the moment.
What, for breakfast?
Yeah.
Avocado on toast, that's nice.
Well, no, I'm not allowed to toast, so I just have avocado on avocado.
Avocado on toast is really, really good.
Very cool.
So, thank you to all our interviewees today, and that's Stephen Dring, Growing Underground, and Lee Shepherd of Appetito, Vic Mystery of Ixion, and of course we had Sugar Vida and Bocca Foods. That's Christina and Franco.
Yeah, fantastic. So thank you for joining us on the Food Talk Show. We'll be back with you, as always, next Thursday with the lovely Sue Nelson and me, Paul Andrews. Don't forget to check out our website, foodtalk.co.uk. There's loads of recipes, interesting articles and podcasts for your delight. So you can go through the week by looking at the website before you hear us again next Thursday.
Listening to a podcast in the gym.
Absolutely, yeah. Have a good week, and we'll be back with you next week. Bye for now.
Bye.